Your Honors, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, keep your eye on the clock. It counts down, and we'll try and keep track with you, but it's up to you to have a look. Okay.
I'm going to address the venue issue first, unless you prefer to talk about the search and seizure issue. But in this case, as the court's well aware, the defendant was picked up for possession, arrested in Washington for possession of methamphetamine, and then later he was charged in Alaska for possession with intent to distribute. And in this case, it's our position that the venue was not in Alaska, that the government did not prove that. And in the government's briefing, they argue at length regarding facts to support a substantial step for attempted possession with intent to distribute, but I think there's some important things that are being glossed over. One of the main
Ms.
things.
Libby, can I just ask you, I didn't notice, is venue an element of the offense here?
No, it's not an element of the offense, but
so
it's
you're,
still.
So you're just talking pure venue, and not having nothing to do with the proving of the crime.
Well, it still has to be proven by the government, but only by a preponderance of the evidence.
Venue has to be proven by a preponderance. Yeah.
Yes.
Is possession with intent to distribute a continuing offense?
Yes.
And it can continue while the person is traveling, can it?
Yes, it can.
Why is venue appropriate wherever he ends up with the contraband?
Well, here he possessed it in Washington, and that's the last place he possessed it. So to get venue in Alaska, it's our position there'd have to be evidence that he intended to distribute it in Alaska.
Well, you know, the crime for which he was committed, for which he was convicted, was not possession, but rather attempt to possess. Isn't
yes.
that correct? So
yes.
I think we should be looking at venue for the crime of which he was convicted. Isn't that right?
Right. And so I think we have to look at whether the substantial step analysis.
Well, I think so. And the venue statute says that there's venue in any district in which such offense was begun. Now, I assume that's the language that is the most troublesome for you. Now, before he left Alaska on his trip down to Tucson to pick up the meth, what did he do?
He got on the plane in Alaska.
Yeah. Did he make any phone calls to Tucson to set this up?
No, he didn't. The government's will try to say that he received a call and then he said, I have to go. But we don't have that he set up the transaction. We don't have that he purchased the drugs. We don't have arrangements in Alaska by him. Another person set up the plane ticket and the travel. But that person's not charged.
Are we allowed to first off consider the evidence that there was such a phone call that he said, I have to go? And if we're allowed to consider that, what inferences can we draw from that phone call?
Well, I think that the problem here is that it's not a conspiracy or an aiding or abetting case, so we can't make the inferences to impute things from another actor that's not charged, because this isn't a conspiracy case.
But aren't you conflating a venue with the substantive crime? I mean, at least as I understand the record, correct me if I'm wrong, Pariseau's girlfriend testified about his previous trips from Alaska to Arizona, learning how to strap the drugs to his leg with ACE bandages, and in this particular case, she claimed she saw Pariseau with meth in Alaska, witnessed a phone call where he agreed to fly to Arizona, which was resulted in his arrest. If that's true, acts as part of this crime occurred in the venue of Alaska, did it not?
Well, it's my argument that those are prior bad acts, and they can be used to show mens rea, but they're not going to show the overt act for purposes of a substantial step. Otherwise, just getting on the plane is enough, but we don't know where the what distribution was ever going to happen. He got off the plane in Seattle. They didn't arrest him or stop him near the gate to Alaska. They stopped him near the restroom, and he could have been leaving the airport.
Well, but he had a ticket. He was changing planes, right?
He had a ticket to go all the way, but that can be a ruse. I mean, he could get off at any stop. And
well, yeah, I understand all those things. Those are, I think, fair subjects for speculation, but all we have to do is preponderance. It seems to me by preponderance of the evidence, it's likely that he was changing planes and he was on his way back to Alaska.
But this court has made it clear that it is, venue is a jury issue, and while it is a different standard, it still has to be, if it's going to be, it's such an important right that it still needs to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and so it has to be substantial and uncontroverted.
Yeah, that's a tricky part of this case. Did you ask for an instruction to go to the jury?
The defendant did not ask for an instruction to go for the jury, and if I can answer this really quickly, I knew you were going to ask me this, the government didn't argue that that was a problem. I'd say that so I don't think it's a waiver issue, but in this case, since the venue issue was denied twice before, so since the court had already ruled on it, it's our position that it wouldn't need to be brought up again as far as a jury question.
And did the defendant, I gather you're here on appeal, but you didn't do the trial?
No, I did not.
Did the defendant at trial say, but Your Honor, this is a jury issue?
No, Your Honor.
So didn't object when the judge said, listen, I'm going to decide the venue issue.
Well, the judge ruled on the venue issue and said, I think it's clear venues in Alaska. And then it didn't come up again. So I think
I'm trying to get this straight. At any point did the defendant say, Judge, this is supposed to go to the jury. This is not for you.
No.
Okay.
I know you want to reserve some time.
Don't worry. We'll make sure you get enough time to respond.
I just want to be sure. When you come up next time, there's a Seventh Circuit case, Muhammad, and a Sixth Circuit case, Zidell. You're probably familiar with both of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like you to address those when you come up again on why at least the reasoning of those cases is not dispositive of the venue issue in this case.
Okay.
Thank you.
Can I say one thing about the search and seizure issue, because I don't want to waive it?
Sure. Say what you need to say.
Okay,
don't worry too much about your time. We'll make sure you get a chance to say what you need to say.
With regard to the consent, I would like to point out that the officer asked Pariso if he would consent to a pat-down, and he said, no, maybe I need to speak to an attorney. He didn't just say, maybe I need to speak to an attorney. He said no. And then Ida can't find any, the government has indicated that the defendant was told he didn't have to consent, and I don't see that anywhere in the record where he was actually told that. And so I think based on the analysis of the factors, there wasn't consent, and the judge didn't make adequate consent findings.
Well, let's add one more case for you to talk about.
Okay.
Davis. When you come up again, talk about Davis and when the Miranda ruling applies as far as asking for counsel or anything of that nature.
Okay.
Thank you.
Wish I hadn't even brought it up.
Well, let's hear from the government.
It pleases the court, James Barkley for the United States. First of all, I'd like to extend the U.S. Attorney's Office welcome to the court, to Alaska. As you know, we have branch offices in Fairbanks, Juneau, and our U.S. Attorney is Karen Leffler, and on behalf of all of them and our appellate coordinator, Joanne Farrington, welcome to Alaska. Hope you enjoyed some of the glorious weather on Saturday, but I have to tell you that today's weather is more typical of a summer day in Alaska. If I might, I'd like to start just by correcting
that. So when Alaska starts that poem, let me compare thee to a summer's day, it's not necessarily a compliment.
The comparison ends there. There should be a period after that.
Yeah, okay.
The comparison ends there. If I might, Your Honors, I'd like to quickly direct the court's attention to the record in the appellant's excerpts of record at page 43. This is the transcript of the dialogue from the suppression hearing between the agent at the Seattle airport seeking consent to search. And he clearly advises Mr. Pariso, who did not say no, by the way. He said, maybe I should speak to a lawyer. But he clearly advises Mr. Pariso as follows, carrying on to page 44. That's well within your rights. So the government contends he told him he didn't have to consent. He then went on to explain, as asserted in the government's brief, that a warrant, he would be detained while a warrant was applied to search his person, and that it was by no means guaranteed that a warrant would be obtained. I would like counsel, to direct most of my argument to the venue issue. The court most recently inquired as to whether the defendant ever sought a venue jury instruction, and I tried the case. The defendant did not do so. nor did the government. And I think in retrospect, now that I know a lot more about venue than I did when this came up the morning of the pretrial conference, I would have asked that the jury be instructed myself. But I didn't ask that either. I think part of the misunderstanding was my fault, because I argued to Judge Beislein, which is in my supplemental excerpt of record, that venue was a question for the judge to decide. And I was just wrong. I had never encountered a serious venue issue before. Most drug crimes prosecuted here, and certainly those that I've ever handled, are ones which, while they are unitary in space and time within the meaning of Corona, they're consummated by the time they end up in the district here. This was a very unusual case. And so
does the government concede that there are no reported cases from the Ninth Circuit that address a venue challenge to an 841 conviction for attempt?
There is one case, Your Honor, I believe the Smith decision, but it was reversed, which is why I didn't cite it. It was reversed for prosecutorial misconduct.
Okay.
So I don't think it had much bearing
on
this case.
So basically, for purposes of our case, although we have the reasoning of the Seventh and the Sixth Circuit, there's no definitive opinion that you're aware of that addresses the issue under a 21 U.S.C. 841 conviction.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. Not squarely on point. Now, there is the Corona decision, which I believe is my best case, because while it did involve a conspiracy and then separate substantive acts of distribution in furtherance of the conspiracy, those acts spanning two states, California and Nevada, this court clearly indicated that 18 U.S. Code Section 3237 applies to drug trafficking crimes.
Now, let me ask you this. I'm just reading the venue statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
May be inquired of and prosecuted in any district in which such offense was begun, continued, or completed.
Yes.
That's 3237A.
Yes.
Are you in agreement that that's the provision we're supposed to look at?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, begun, I discussed briefly with your adversary. I'd like to focus for a moment on the words that come after that.
Yes.
Continued. Was it continued in Alaska?
Your Honor, I believe in almost a sense of examining the physics of the continuum from the time Mr. Parasol parked his Jeep at the airport and got onto the airplane, that there is a continuation
there. So if it was begun in Alaska, I guess it was continued up until such point as the airplane leaves Alaskan airspace.
Well, this raises the question of 18 U.S. Code 3238, which would address what happens in the air.
Okay, or at least until he gets on the airplane.
I believe overflight of Alaska until he gets out of Alaska, the district of Alaska, which would be down near Ketchikan. I believe that would be consistent with Corona and other cases. That's still the district of Alaska.
Okay, and I think I know the answer to this one. I want to make sure that we just cover it thoroughly.
Yes, sir.
Was the offensive conviction completed in Alaska? I think the answer has to be no, because they stopped him in Seattle.
There's no evidence that it was completed in Alaska, Your Honor. Yes,
well, there's lots of evidence that it wasn't, because they stopped him in Seattle.
Yes, he did not obtain that cocaine on the airplane headed for Seattle on the way out.
So if we're going to get venue, you've got to do either it was begun in Alaska or continued in Alaska, or maybe both.
Possibly both.
And the fact that it was aimed at Alaska,
yes,
I think is off the table, because it wasn't completed in Alaska. He maybe wanted to complete it in Alaska, but he didn't.
Well, it's off the table, I believe, Your Honor, under Ninth Circuit precedent. However, the government has argued that because this was aimed solely at Alaska, this offense from beginning to end was aimed solely at Alaska.
Well, I'd be very sympathetic to that argument if the statute said aimed.
Well,
the statute says completed.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it wasn't completed.
Muhammad?
In Alaska.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. Muhammad and Zidell, cases which both referred to 3237, did not require that the offense have been completed for the court to consider, among all factors, whether venue was proper.
I don't think they can read English. But I'm not sure you lose, because let's focus back on the begun. I mean, what happened in Alaska before he left?
Here's what happened, John. First of all, the government put on evidence at trial of conduct immediately preceding the events of October 14th, when the defendant got on the airplane on this fateful third trip. And the government argued to the jury that these events were so close in time that essentially an ongoing course of conduct, a reliable prediction, which is part of the court's effort in a venue case, a reliable prediction of what the defendant was doing when he went to the airport on October 14th, was already in place based upon existing facts. The defendants live in...
Why are we talking about prediction? Why aren't we saying, listen, it looks as though, sounds like you got a telephone call that set up the deal, at least at the point of where he's supposed to go to Tucson.
Yes,
so,
sir.
This is an attempt. It's not, you're not prosecuting him now for conviction, for possession. It's rather for attempt to possess.
Yes, sir.
He gets a phone call.
He gets a phone call.
I think the reasonable inference from the fact of the phone call is that somebody is saying, hey, the deal's on, come on down to Tucson. He gets on the airplane.
Well, Your Honor, actually, I think the evidence is quite clear at trial that it was not a person in Arizona or saying coming down to Tucson. The person who made the phone call was actually identified by the defense in cross-examination as Mr. Stearns, who lives in Talkeetna, just where Mr. Pariseau did. Right. And the defense throughout the trial asserted that Mr. Pariseau was only a mule for this Mr. Stearns. Over the repeated objections of the government has never relied on imputing any acts by Mr. Stearns to the defendant for purposes of venue. But the meaning of the phone call is established by the witness who handed the phone to Mr. Pariseau, his girlfriend. She said she recognized it as Mr. Stearns, that is his voice, and she's had this phone call before, two other times. Pursuant to which, she packed a bag for Mr. Pariseau, drove with him in her Jeep to the Anchorage Airport, sent him off to Tucson. He came back virtually overnight both times, and on one occasion, one of those trips, she testified she saw two bags of methamphetamine in the back seat of the truck.
Okay, I got it.
So bottom line, for purposes of 3237A, the government believes that although this crime finished in Seattle because it didn't go any farther, it started here, and therefore it satisfies that statute.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the actions that you believe started here were what? The phone call, going to the airport, getting on the plane with that intent? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor. And also parking the Jeep there is a significant event. Judge Beischlein specifically referred to it in finding that there was venue under 3237. It's also significant, Your Honor, and it's actually an issue that's all bound up in the propriety of venue in this case. I argued to the jury, and you can tell from today's weather, this is a good day in summer. In wintertime, in October, no Alaskan in his or her right mind would go down to Tucson, Arizona, stay for 18 hours total and be back in Alaska.
They'd just stay down there?
Well, they'd stay for a couple of days at least, because we need sunshine at that time of the year. The days are already getting short. It's nonsensical that an Alaskan would spend nearly $1,500 on a round trip prepaid ticket to Tucson, Arizona, without having made prior arrangements that you could count on. And the proof that the firmness of the defendant's resolve was to go down there and get meth again was the evidence of his live-in roommate that he had done that twice before, less than 3 weeks before this trip.
But for purposes of the venue, I believe your opposing counsel conceded, and I gather the government does as well, that venue is not an element of the crime of conviction. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So for purposes of the venue part, we're just talking about whether 3237A has been satisfied. You indicated what your points are, the phone call, parking of the Jeep, I suppose getting on the airplane, occurred in the District of Alaska. That is part of the what statute here talks about, begun in one district and completed in another. And that,
yes.
That satisfies it.
Yes, Your Honor. And there's one more act that the government would allude to. The government used some evidence in terms of viewing the defendant's intent and getting on the airplane October 14th. From before that time, there's one jail phone call that, while the defendant was in Seattle, was played for the jury. And in that, the defendant expressed his regret. That is, it's a backward-looking regret. And the government argued at trial also that that was an admission by the defendant, that when he went to the airport, he was going to Tucson to get the drugs. And he regretted now that he did it because he got caught.
But are you contending that that phone call occurred in the District of Alaska?
No, but he was speaking to his girlfriend who was in the District of Alaska.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with preparation, but it's an admission after the fact of what his intent was when he left on October 14th.
So that gives more meaning to the phone call, the parking of the Jeep, and so on.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, you might have noticed that we let the government go over, so. You say what you need to say.
The court had asked me to address Muhammad and Zidel, and I think the test in Muhammad goes too far because it basically indicates that the aim of the crime, wherever that, or there's an effect, if the crime has an effect on a jurisdiction, that will establish sufficient venue. And if you look at this court's precedent, it's not that easy to get venue. And here, I'm not going to dispute, the defendant possessed the drugs, and so he begun the crime of possession, and he actually completed that crime, but there's
But you see, here I think it's important that the crime of which he was convicted is not possession. If the crime were only possession, I might be very sympathetic to the idea he didn't begin the crime of possession until he possessed. But the crime for which he was convicted was attempt. So when does he start trying?
Well, I will agree that he got on the plane and, well, he got acquired the drugs in Arizona. So I would argue that that's where the attempt began, because until he went.
So what was he doing in Alaska when he gets that phone call?
Well,
he gets on the airplane. Was he just at that point thinking he's going to go for a quick swim and come home?
Well, he still has to intend to distribute the drugs. I mean, this case is unusual because we don't have any buy set up. We don't have any potential buyer. We don't have any transaction that's going to happen with these drugs that he possessed. They don't have any evidence of that.
Those aren't elements of the crime, are they?
Well, they're indicative of intent to distribute.
Well, they're indicative, but the reality is it's possession, or rather attempt to possess. And you don't have to show anything as an element of that crime, do you? What he was going to do with it afterwards?
To prove intent to distribute, I think you do. I think that was proven here, right? No, I don't. Well, I don't think it was proven that it would happen in Alaska. They didn't say that he had to intend to distribute the drugs in Alaska. The jury instructions just say, you know, attempted possession with intent to distribute.
So your case basically rises and falls on the venue statute from your perspective. You want a new shot, you have to do it because it shouldn't have occurred, shouldn't have been tried before Judge Weisland.
Right, yes. And so I think Muhammad went too far. It's too easy of a test to me. And also, in both the cases, Muhammad and Zidel, the facts are, there's more facts of arranging the transaction by the defendant in the jurisdiction where he's charged with the crime. And so, and the Zidel case is a conspiracy case, so, and there was an aider abettor theory, so it's a different analysis. And the Supreme Court has indicated that, and so has this circuit, that, I mean, group liability is a separate issue, and we just don't have it here. The government said that the prior flight was close in time. There was a prior travel by the defendant that indicates his venue in this case, but the flight, the 9/17/2008 travel, the government didn't know that there's testimony that they didn't know if Pariso got drugs on that flight. And I'll just refer to that. 9/17/2008, too uncertain info, we think he went and picked up drugs. They just thought he went and picked up drugs. And that's in the transcript at page 2 or 26 for Officer Pronto's testimony. So I don't think that's enough there to have the prior bad acts connect this.
You want to talk about Davis and the...
Well, the only thing, I'm assuming you're talking about maybe doesn't trigger the right to Miranda. Is that the Davis case you're talking about?
Yeah, well, the real question I'm asking is whether you are somehow alleging that he was sufficiently detained that if he even intimated that he wanted to talk to a lawyer, that he had to be Mirandized before he went from there. You got, after Davis applies, and there's some discussion about when that occurs, then you've got to be really, really definite about it. But before that, maybe not so much. So, but this is, I gather this is nothing that was raised in any of the pleadings, right?
Well, his statements were suppressed, and the trial judge concluded that he should have been Mirandized when he was detained on the concourse. Mm-hmm. And that was when he had said maybe, and nothing after that came in. So I didn't see it as an issue.
So basically, whatever the issues behind Davis, as far as you're concerned, that's all been resolved. We don't need to consider Miranda issues.
No, because we had a favorable Miranda ruling.
Okay, all right.
So if I have more I could say, but I've used up all my time.
I think you covered the ground very nicely.
I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank both sides for their very helpful arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor.
United States versus Paraso now submitted for decision.